Chapter 5. The barrel, the first inanimate object they had seen outside their own wooden world for what already seemed an age, was watched intently by all hands as it bobbed closer. And when at last it came aboard, seized with some difficulty by Bondon and Yardley, tossing on the choppy sea in the doctor's skiff, most of the Surprise's former whalers came as far aft alongside the gangway as was decent, for the cask was seen to be bound with withers, not with iron hoops, not man-of-war fashion, nor even that of a China-going ship.
"Mr. Vidor," said Jack, "you have been in the South Sea fishery. What do you make of it?"
"Why, sir," said Vidor, "I should say it is a Yankee barrel. But I sailed out of London River, and never was in those ports. Simon and Trotter would know more."
"Pass the word for Simon and Trotter,"
said Jack, and they instantly stepped on to the quarter-deck.
"Martha's Vineyard," said Trotter, turning the barrel in his hands.
"Nantucket," said Simon. "I was married there, once."
"Then how come it has Isaac Taylor's mark?" asked Trotter.
"Well, any road," said Simon, looking fixedly at Jack. "This here is a Yankee barrel, sir. What they call a Bedford hog in New England, and it has not been in the water a couple of days. There is no sea clamour on it, and the dowels is sound. They would never have heaved it over the side without they had a full hold and homeward bound."
All within earshot nudged one another, grinning. Their prize money clanked in their loaded hats. They were delighted at the idea of even more. Jack considered the sky, the set of the sea, the breeze, and the current. The whole ship's company, eminently professional, did the same. The only exception was Dr. Maturin, who considered a thin line of birds high and remote. When he had fixed them in his pocket-glass, no simple feat with the increasing swell, he put them down as southern cousins to the Kittiwake. They were gliding steadily east-southeast. For a moment he thought of offering Martin the little telescope, but he decided against it. For their part, Martin and Dutot were contemplating the seamen, their profoundly serious, concentrated weighing of the sea, the weather, the possibilities of a capture. And Stephen heard Martin say, "Homo hominis lupus?" Jack called the Franklin up by signal, and when she was within half a cable's length he stepped right aft and called out,
"Tom, we have picked up a barrel, seemingly fresh, perhaps from a Yankee whaler. Bear away to leeward and let us sweep on our former course."
Not a great deal was left of the tropical day, but until the very dipping of the sun every masthead was manned and relieved every bell, and some lingered on throughout the brief twilight. Even the most sanguine had known that the chance of finding a ship in this immensity of ocean, with no more than a barrel and the known habits of South Sea whalers for guidance, was very remote, although hope was sustained by the presence of seabirds, rather uncommon in these blue waters, travelling in the same direction. The chief basis of this hope was a fervent desire that it should be fulfilled, and it sank steadily with the coming of the night, sweeping up deep purple from the east, already flecked with stars. Now, in the last dog watch, as the last men came slowly down, dispirited, it revived, rising high above its former merely speculative pitch, for the Franklin, far over to leeward, sent up a blue flare, followed shortly after by a night signal, a hoist of lanterns. Reed was signal midshipman, and with his telescope poised on Weddell's shoulder, he read off the hoist to his captain in a firm, official voice.
"Telegraphic, sir. Alphabetic. K-R-E-N-G. Kreng, sir."
"I hope I've got it right," he added in a more human tone.
"Kreng!"
cried a dozen voices on the gangway, and the helmsman, in a low, kindly murmur, said to Reed,
"That's what we call a corpus, sir. A carcass with his head emptied of spermaceti and the blubber all stripped off."
Jack took the Franklin's bearing, said,
"Mr. Reed, acknowledge and make the signal, course south-southeast by east, close-reefed topsails."
This same course took the Surprise past the dead whale soon after the moon had risen. White birds whirled and flashed through the beams of the stern lantern. They could scarcely be identified, some pied petrels and possibly a few of the small albatrosses apart from gulls, but on the other hand, the huge carcass, rolling in the phosphorescent sea, was perfectly clear.
"I reckon he would have been an old 80-barrel bull," observed Granger,
standing at the rail by Stephen's side.
They are not as troublesome as the young ones, not being so nimble, but they sound mighty deep. I've known one take out the line of four boats and end 800 fathom. Can you imagine it? And when they come up, they're apt to turn awkward and snap your boat in two. But may I say, Doctor, he added in a hesitant murmur, I saw your mate catting over the side, to windward, poor soul, and then he went below looking right sickly. Could he have eaten something, do you suppose?
Perhaps he may, though possibly it is the lively motion of the ship with these short, sudden seas and all this spray.
To be sure, the breeze is dead against the current now, and the stream has grown stronger with the main not so very far away.
However, Martin seemed reasonably well for their morning rounds, though the sea was livelier still, and the ship pitched with more than ordinary force as they sailed large under mere topsails and the close-reefed, sweeping as wide an expanse of the somewhat hazy sea as ever they could, perpetually looking for their quarry or to their consort for a signal. Theoretically, each could see at least 15 miles in all directions, and even with the necessity for keeping within clear signalling distance, they covered a vast area. But the veering wind brought low scud, and it was not until early in the forenoon watch, with the misty sun two spans above the horizon, that the exultant hail, "Sail ho!" came down from the masthead, echoing below, even into the sick berth itself.
"We found them!"
cried Martin, with a triumph that contrasted strangely with his now habitually anxious, withdrawn, cheerless expression.
"Go along, my dears,"
said Stephen to the little girls, whose duties were already over, and with a sketch of a bob they flitted away into the dark orlop, scattering rats and cockroaches as they ran, invisible but for their white pinafores. Stephen finished rubbing blue ointment into Douglas Murd, washed his hands, tossed Martin the towel, called to Badine,
"Let the glasses dry of themselves,"
and ran on deck, joining almost all the ship's company who were not aloft.
"Ho, Doctor," called Jack from the starboard rail. "Here's an elegant spectacle."
He nodded forward over the short, tossing, angry sea, and as he nodded, a sperm whale rose not 10 yards out, blew a fine spout, breathed audibly, and dived, a great, smooth roll. The spout swept aft along the deck, and beyond it Stephen saw the whaler clear, directly to windward. Beyond her, two boats close together, and farther still, a mile and more to the east, three more.
"They were so busy with their fish they did not see us till a moment ago. The boats in the north-northeast have not seen us yet. But look at the men on board the ship. Parcel of old women!"
He passed the telescope, and at once that remote deck sprang close, sharp and distinct, visibly dirty and disordered even from here. Not many people still aboard, but those few running about with great activity and little apparent purpose, while a person in the crow's nest waved his arms with uncommon vehemence, pointing to the south.
"Mr. Granger," called Jack, "pray explain the situation to the doctor."
He took back his telescope, slung it, and ran up the masthead like a boy.
"Why, sir," said Granger, in his comfortable West Country voice, "those far-off boats away to the eastward are fast to a girt old bull, running like a coach and six on a turnpike. George, tell our William to bring my other spyglass and bear a hand, bear a hand. Now, do you see," he went on when it came, "there is the headsman standing in the bows with his lance, to kill the whale when he rises. It was the boat steerer sent the harpoon home, of course, and now he is in the stern again.
A very broad-shouldered man.
They generally are. The other boats are standing by, right close, ready to pass their lines in case he sounds again and deeper still. Now, if you look back to the ship, sir, you will see they have had a fine morning. Two whales killed and fast to a third. They are emptying the first one's head alongside now, or were until they saw us and started their capering. And an awkward time they were having of it, with the short seas breaking over all. And the two boats close to are towing in the second fish. Those fast to the girt old bull ain't seen us yet, watching so eager. But I dare say the ship will give them a gun presently."
Stephen gazed and gazed, the little figures hurrying and jerking about in the distant whaler, though clear, were perfectly mute, inaudible, which added a ludicrous side to their distress. Some, including a man who was presumably the master, since he beat and cuffed the others, were struggling round the great tripods set up amidships to melt the blubber, struggling to get a gun clear of all the trying-out gear, the casks, and the general whaler-like disorder. The man in the crow's nest seems very earnest in urging them to go away to the right. He leaps up and down.
"Why, yes, sir. The Franklin lies there in the west. Ain't you noticed?"
"To tell you the truth, I had not. But why should he want them to go to her?"
"Because she is wearing American colours, in course, whereas we wear the ensign. That is the captain's guile, you see. In any case, they certainly know her, she having been a privateering in these waters since March, and the lookout wants them to make sail for her while there is yet time. They do not know she is took. As the breeze lays now, we should need 2 longboards or tacks, if you follow me, to come up with her, and by then she could just squeeze under the Franklin's lee."
"Little good would it do them?"
"None at all, Doctor. But they don't know it, nor they don't know what metal we carry."
"Would it not mean abandoning their friends over there in the east?"
"Oh, yes. And it would mean abandoning 3 good fish, enough to break a whaler's heart. I doubt they do it. They're more likely to wait for the Franklin to come up, and then brazen it out the 2 of them, either hoping we will sheer off, or putting before the wind and running for it, the one supporting the other. But her master might possibly think it worthwhile to save a full hold. And then, you know, sir," said Granger in a low, confidential tone, "a whaler's crew ships by the lay. No wages but a share in the profits. So the fewer come home, the more the survivors gain."
"Oh, by God, they're doing it!" he cried. "They are leaving their friends behind!"
Indeed, the hands had dropped the gun for the yards and braces, and the nearer boats, having cast off their whale, were racing for the side, tearing through the broken sea. The sails dropped, the yards rose up, the ship's head turned, and as the men from the 2 boats scrambled aboard, she gathered way. She had a fine to-gallant breeze on her quarter, and she moved at a surprising pace. Her people packed on sail faster than would have been believed possible for so few hands, and their calculations were right. The whaler, wearing American colours on every mast, reached the Franklin well before the Surprise, which had paused to take the eastern boats in tow. When the whaler was within pistol shot, the Franklin hauled down her stars and stripes, hoisted the ensign, and sent a 24-pound ball skipping across the whaler's forefoot. She let fly her sheets, and Tom Pullings hailed her in a voice of brass.
"Strike your colours, and come under my lee!"
She was still lying there when the Surprise came up, with the eastern boats strung out behind her. Jack rounded to and ranged up on the whaler's starboard side.
"I have left her for you, sir,"
called Pullings across the prize's deck.
"Quite right, Tom,"
replied Jack, and wiping the spray from his face, for even here in the lee of 2 ships the waves were chopping high, he gave the order,
"Blue cutter away! Mr. Granger, go across if you please. Take possession and send the master back with his papers. The whaler, ahoy!"
"Sir, start a couple of casks, 4 and aft, do you hear me there?"
"Aye, aye, sir,"
said the master, a sparse, hard-featured man, now awkwardly willing to please, and a moment later whale oil poured from the scuppers, spreading with extreme rapidity. The sea did not cease heaving, but the spray no longer flew. There was no white water, no breaking between the ships, nor a way to leeward.
"Should you like to go, Doctor?"
asked Jack, turning kindly.
"I believe you always wanted to look into a whaler."
Stephen bowed and quickly tied a length of bandage over his hat and wig, tying it under his chin. Jack directed his voice towards the half-swamped whaleboats astern.
"You fellows had better go aboard before you are drowned."
It took some little time to get the doctor safely down into the blue cutter. It took longer to get him up the oily side of the whaler, where the master stretched down an officious hand and Bondon thrust him from below. But he was scarcely on the filthy deck before the whaleboat crews came swarming aboard with their gear, the headsmen carrying their lances, the boat steerers their shining harpoons. They boarded mostly on the quarter, coming up nimbly as cats, and raced forward with a confused bellow. The master back to the mainmast.
"You left us to starve on the ocean, you rat!" roared the first headsman.
"You made all sail and cracked on! Cracked on!"
roared the second, shaking his lance, barely articulate.
"Judas!" said the third.
"Now, Zeke!" cried the master. "You put down that lance. I should have picked you up."
The broad-shouldered harpooner, the man who had been fast to the big bull whale, was last up the side. He heaved his way through the shouting, tight-packed throng. He said nothing, but he flung his iron straight through the master's breast, deep into the wood. Returning to the surprise, covered with blood, a useless investigation, heart split, spinal cord severed, Stephen was met with the news that Martin had been taken ill. He dabbled his hands in a bucket of seawater and hurried below. In spite of the activity on deck, the gunroom was an example of the inevitably promiscuous nature of life at sea, with two anxious-looking officers sitting at the table with biscuit and mugs of soup in front of them, the cook standing at the door with a bill of fare in his hand, and the grizzle-bearded lady of the gunroom at his side, all of them listening with concern to Martin's groans and stifled exclamations in the quarter-gallery, or rather the nasty little enclosure just aft by the bread bins that served the gunroom for a quarter-gallery or house of ease, the deck being too low for anything more luxurious than a bucket. Eventually he came out, fumbling at his clothes, looking inhuman. He staggered to his cabin and fell onto his cot, breathing quick and shallow. Stephen followed him. He sat on a stool and said in a low voice, close to Martin's head, "Dear colleague, I am afraid you are far from well. May I not do something, mix a gentle palliative, a soothing draught?"
"No, no, I thank you," said Martin. "It is a passing indisposition. All I need is rest and quiet."
He turned away. It was clear to Stephen that at this stage there was nothing more he could usefully say, and when Martin's breathing grew easier, he left him. The rest of the ship was full of life, with prisoners coming aboard with their chests and a prize crew going across to take over. And as usual, the whaler's hands were being checked against her muster book by Mr. Adams, the captain's clerk, in the great cabin. Jack and Tom Pullings were there, watching the men, listening to their answers, and making up their minds how they should be divided. They were heavy, sad, disappointed men at present, with a hold of their 3 years' cruise taken from them in a moment. But their spirits would revive, and many an enterprising band of prisoners had risen upon their captors and seized the ship. Moreover, sailors from the northern colonies could prove as troublesome and pugnacious as Irishmen. It appeared, however, that no more than a score of them belonged to the original crew from Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, and New Bedford. In 3 years, many had died by violence, disease, or drowning, whilst two or three had run, and their places had been filled with South Sea Islanders and what could be picked up in the odd Pacific port: Portuguese, Mexican, half-castes, a wandering Chinese. A fairly simple division, though the surprise was already somewhat short of hands. The last, a thick-set youngish man who had lingered behind, came to a halt before the table and called out,
"Edward Shelton, sir, headsman, starboard watch, born in Wapping,"
in a strong, undoubted Wapping voice.
"Then what are you doing in an enemy ship?"
asked Adams.
"Wish I went a-whaling during the peace and joined this here ship long before the American War was declared,"
said Shelton, his words carrying perfect conviction.
"May I speak a word to the captain?"
Adams looked at Jack, who said,
"What have you to say, Shelton?"
in a tone that, though mild enough, promised nothing.
"You don't know me, sir,"
said Shelton, putting a doubled forefinger to his forehead in the naval way.
"But I've seen you often enough in Port Mahone, when you had the Sophie. I've seen you come in with a cacafuego at your tail, sir. I meant your time when you came aboard Euryalus, Captain Dundas, Captain Heneage Dundas in Pompey. I was one of the sidemen."
"Well, Shelton," said Jack, after a question or two for conscience' sake, "if you choose to return to your natural service, to enter voluntarily, you shall have the bounty, and I will find you a suitable rating."
"Thank you kindly, Your Honour," said Shelton. "But what I mean is, we cleared from Callao on the 7th, and while we were getting our stores aboard, tar, cordage, sailcloth, and stockfish, there was a merchantman belonging to Liverpool, homeward bound from the northwoods, in dock, tightening up for her run round the Horn. We cleared on the 7th, which it was a Tuesday, homeward bound too, though not really full. Not a right good voyage, not heart's content, as you might say, but middling. And off the Chinches, at break of day, there was a four-masted ship directly to windward, man-of-war fashion. The master said, 'I know her, mate, she's a friend, a Frenchman out of Bordeaux, a privateer.' And he lay to. There was nothing else he could do, dead to leeward of a ship of 32 guns with yards like Kingdom Come and a black flag lying at her masthead. But as we lay there, he walked fore and aft, gnawing his fingers and saying, 'Jeez, I hope he remembers me. God Almighty, I hope he remembers me. Chuck, that was his mate, and aunt's own child, likely he'll remember us, don't you reckon? Well, he did remember us. He hauled down his black flag and we lay alongside one another, matey matey. He asked after Liverpool's ship, and we told him she would be out of dock in under a month. So he said he would stretch away to the westward for a while on a chance of an English whaler or a China ship, and then lie off the Chinches again. And he told us the sea 30 leagues to the west-northwest was full of whales, thick with whales. We sailed together, separating gradually, and a day after we had sunk his topgallants, there we were in the middle of them, spouting all round the compass.
Tell me about her guns.
32 nine-pounders, sir, or maybe 12s. In any case, all brass, besides her chasers. I never seen a privateer so set out. But I did not like to go aboard or look too curious, let alone ask no questions, not with that crowd of villains.
Was their black flag in earnest?
Oh, yes, sir, deadly earnest. They were as thorough-paced and no quarter given or asked as ever I saw. Trample the crucifix any day of the week. But you and your consort could deal with her. I dare say Surprise could do so on her own, though it might be nip and tack. And she would buy it very dear, they haven't to sink or be sunk. Which I mean, if they are killed, they are deaders, and if they are taken, they are hanged. It is half a dozen of the one, and...
His voice died away. He hung his head. A certain coldness having told him that he had been talking too much.
As taut as it is long, said Jack, not unkindly. Well, Shelton, is Mr. Adams to write you down as pressed or volunteer?
Oh, volunteer, sir, if you please, cried Shelton.
Make it so, Mr. Adams, and rate him able for the moment, starboard watch, said Jack.
He wrote on a piece of paper.
Shelton, give this to the officer of the watch. Well, Tom,
he went on after the man had gone,
what do you think?
I believe him, sir, every word, said Pullings. I'm not to put my opinion before yours, but I believe him.
So did I, said Jack,
and the old experienced Adams nodded his head. Jack rang the bell.
Pass the word for Mr. Veedle.
And a few moments later,
Mr. Veedle, when we have seen the whaler's mate and her charts, and when we have shifted as much water out of her as can be done in 30 minutes, you will take command and steer for Callao, under moderate sail. We are running down no great way in the hope of a Frenchman, and it is likely we shall overtake you. If we do not, wait there. Mr. Adams will give you the necessary papers and the name of our agent. He looked after the frigate's prizes on the way out. You may take the whaler's mate, boatswain and cook, no arms, of course, either on themselves or in their chests, and several of our people.
Very good, sir, said Veedle, unmoved.
As for getting the water across, you have half an hour. There is not a minute to lose, and since the sea is a little choppy, spend the oil and spare not. A couple of casks are neither here nor there.
Aye, aye, sir. Spend and spare not as it is.
Jack,
cried Stephen, coming into their strangely late and even twilight dinner.
Did you know that those active mariners have brought a large number of hogsheads aboard, and they filled with fresh water?
Have they, indeed?
Asked Jack.
You amaze me.
They have, too. May I have some to sponge my patience and have their clothes washed at last?
Well, I suppose you may have a little for sponging them. A very small bowl would be enough, I'm sure. But as for washing clothes... Washing clothes, good Lord, that will be a most shocking expenditure, you know. Salt does herrings no harm, nor lobsters, and my shirt has not been washed in fresh water since heaven knows how long. It is like coarse emery paper. No, let us wait for the rain. Have you looked at the glass?
I have not.
It began dropping in the first dog. It has already reached 29 inches, and it is still falling. Look at the meniscus. And the wind is hauling aft. If the rain don't come down in great black squalls tonight or tomorrow, you shall have one of these hogsheads. Well, half a hogshead, for your clothes.
After a short, dissatisfied silence, Dr. Maturin said,
It will be no news to you, Shaw, that the whaler has slipped away, going, they tell me, to Callao, if ever they can find the place, God be with them.
I had noticed it,
said Jack through his sea pie.
But you may not know that two of her men forgot their appeals entirely, or that in his legitimate agitation Padine gave Smith a liniment, not telling him it was to be rubbed in rather than drunk. However, nobody, Nobody has told me why we are rushing in this impetuous manner through the turgid sea with sailors whose names I do not even know, rushing almost directly away, to judge by the sun, away from the Peru I had so longed to see, and which you had led me confidently to expect before Bridie's birthday.
I never said which birthday, this or the next.
I wonder you can speak with such levity about my daughter. I have always treated yours with proper respect.
You called them a pair of turnip-headed swabs once, when they were still in long clothes.
For shame, Jack, a hissing shame upon you. Those were your very own words when you showed them to me at Ashgrove before our voyage to the Mauritius. You're sold to the devil.
Well, perhaps they were.
Yes, you're quite right, I remember now.
You warned me not to toss them into the air as being bad for the intellects. I beg pardon. But tell me, brother, has nobody told you what is afoot?
They have not.
Where have you been?
I have been in my cabin downstairs, contemplating on Mercury.
A delightful occupation, but he is not to be seen now, you know. He is too near the sun. And to tell you the truth, he is neither much of a spectacle nor a great help in navigation, though charming from the purely astronomical point of view.
I meant the metallic element. In its pure state, quicksilver is perfectly neutral. You may swallow half a pint without harm. But in its various combinations it is sometimes benign. Where would you portly men be without the blue pill? And sometimes, when exhibited by inexpert hands, its compounds are mortal in doses so small they can hardly be conceived.
So you know nothing of what is going forward?
Brother, how tedious you can be on occasion! I did hear some cries of Jolly Rogers, Jolly Rogers, we shall Roger them. But in parenthesis, Jack, tell me about this word Roger. I've often heard it aboard, but can make out no clear nautical signification.
Oh, it is no sea term. They use it ashore much more than we do. A low cant expression meaning to swive or couple with.
Stephen considered for a moment and then said,
So Roger joins bugger in that even coarser word, and they are all used in defiance and contempt as though to an enemy, which seems to show a curious light on the lover's subjacent emotions. Conquest, rape, subjugation. Have women a private language of the same nature, I wonder?
Jack said,
In some parts of the West Country, rams are called Roger, as cats are called puss. And, of course, that is their duty. Though which came first, the deed or the doer, the goose or the egg, I am not learned enough to tell.
Would it not be the owl, after all?
Never in life, my poor Stephen. Whoever heard of a golden owl? But let me tell you why we are cracking on like this in what promises to be a very dirty night. There was an Englishman called Shelton in the whaler's crew, a foremast Jack in Euryalus when Heneage Dundas had her. He told us of a French foremaster fitted out man-of-war fashion, Alastor by name, that attacks anything she can overpower, whatever its nation. A genuine pirate wearing the black flag, the Jolly Roger, which means strike and like to, or we shall kill every man and boy aboard. We ask no quarter, we give no quarter. We have checked Shelton's account. We have looked at the whaler's chart, pricked all the way from their leaving Callao to yesterday at sunset, and we know just about where the Alastor must be. She means to sail back to the coast and wait off the Chinchas for a Liverpool ship now docking at Callao for the homeward run. Listen.
The companion overhead lit with three flashes of extreme brilliance. Thunder cracked and bellowed at masthead height, and then came the all-pervading sound of enormous rain. Not exactly a roar, but of such a volume that Jack had to lean over the table and raise his powerful voice to tell Stephen that
now he could sponge his patients, aye, and wash them and their clothes too. There would be enough for the whole ship's company. The first 10 minutes would carry off all the filth, and then they would whip off the tarpaulins and fill the boats and scuttlebutts.
The rain had no great effect on the swell, rolling strong from the northwest, but it flattened the surface almost as effectually as oil, doing away with countless superficial noises, so that the great voice of the rain came right down into the sick berth itself. And Stephen, on his evening rounds, had to repeat his exclamation,
I am astonished to see you here, Mr. Martin. You are not fit to be up and must go back to bed directly.
Of course he was not fit to be up. His eyes were deep sunk in his now bony head. His lips were barely visible, and although he said,
It is only a passing indisposition, as I told you, and now it is over,
he had to grip the medicine chest to keep upright.
Nonsense,
said Stephen. "You must go back to bed directly. That is an order, my dear sir. Padine, help Mr. Martin to his cabin, will you now?" When Stephen's work was done, he walked up the ladder and into the gunroom. His was not exactly a seaman's step. There was something too tentative and crab-like for that, but no landsman would have accomplished it, paying so little attention to the motion in that pitching ship as she raced with a full topsail gale 3 points on her quarter, her stern rising up and up on the following swell. Nor would a landsman have stood there, barely conscious of the heave, as he considered his messmate's dwelling place. It was a long, dim, corridor-like room, some 18 feet wide and 28 in length, with an almost equally long table running down the middle, and the officers' cabin doors opening onto the narrow space on either side, opening outwards, since if they opened the other way they must necessarily crush the man within. There was no one in the gunroom at present, apart from a seaman who was polishing the table and the foot of the mizzenmast, which rose nobly through it halfway along. Though Wilkins, whose watch had just been relieved, could be heard snoring in the aftermost larboard doghole. Yet at four bells the table would be lined with men eager for their supper. Dutot was likely to be invited, and he was certain to talk. The ransomers were nearly always noisy. It was no place for a sick man. He walked into Martin's cabin and sat down by his cot. Since Martin had retired by order, their relations were now changed to those between physician and patient, the physician's authority being enormously enhanced by the Articles of War. In any case, a certain frontier had been crossed, and at present Stephen felt no more hesitation about dealing with this case than he would have done if Martin had all at once run mad, so that he had to be confined. Martin's breathing was now easy, and he appeared to be in a very deep, almost comatose sleep, but his pulse made Stephen most uneasy. Presently, shaking his head, he left the cabin. At the foot of the ladder he saw young Weddell coming down, soaked to the skin.
"Pray, Mr. Weddell," he said, "is the captain on deck?"
"Yes, sir. He's on the forecastle looking out ahead." Stephen grasped the handrail, but Weddell cried, "May I take him a message, sir? I'm wet as a whale already."
"That would be very kind. Pray tell him, with my compliments, that Mr. Martin is far from well, that I should like to move him to the larboard midshipman's berth, and that I should be obliged for 2 strong, sensible hands."
The hands in question, Bondon and a powerful forecastleman who might have been his elder brother, took a quick, seaman-like glance at the situation, and with no more than a, "By the head, mate, handsomely now," they unshipped Martin's cot, carrying him forward in it at a soft, barefoot trot to the empty larboard berth, where Padine had cleared the deck and hung a lantern. They were of opinion that the doctor's mate was as drunk as Davy's sow. And indeed, the inert relaxation, the now stertorous breathing, gave that impression. It was not the case, however. Nathaniel Martin had lain down in his clothes, and now, as Stephen and Padine undressed him, as limp as a man deeply stunned, they saw the recent and exacerbated sores over much of his body.
"Would this be the leprosy, Your Honour?"
asked Padine, his low, hesitant speech made slower, more hesitant by the shock.
"It would not," said Stephen. "It is the cruel salt on a very sensitive skin, and an ill habit of constitution. Go and fetch fresh water. It will be to be had by now. Warm if ever the galley is lit, 2 sponges, 2 towels, and clean sheets from the chest by my bed. Ask Killick for those that were last washed in fresh."
"Salt and worse on a sensitive mind, an unhappy mind," he added to himself. Leprosy he had seen often enough, eczemas, of course, and prickly heat carried to the extreme, but never anything quite like this. There were many things about Martin's state that he could not make out, and although analogies kept flitting through his mind like clues to the solution of a puzzle, none would settle or cling to its fellows. Padine returned, and they washed Martin with warm, fresh water all over twice, then laid on sweet oil wherever it would do good, wrapping him at last naked in a clean sheet. No nightshirt was called for in this steady warmth. From time to time he groaned or uttered a disconnected word. Twice he opened his eyes, raised his head, and stared about, uncomprehending. Once he took a little water with insipisated lemon juice in it, but generally speaking he was wholly inert, and the habitual look of anxiety had left his face. When he sent Padine to bed, Stephen sat on. In sponging Martin, he had looked very attentively for signs of the venereal disorder that he had at one time suspected. There were none. As a naval surgeon, he had a great experience of the matter, and there were no signs at all. He knew, as any medical man must know, that mind could do astonishing things to body. False pregnancies, for example, with evident tangible lactation and all the other marks of gravidity. But the lesions now before him were of another kind, and more virulent. Martin might believe himself poxed, and the belief might induce skin troubles, some forms of paralysis, constipation or uncontrolled flux, and in a man like Martin all the consequences of extreme anxiety, guilt and self-loathing. But not these particular miseries. He had seen something of the same nature in a patient whose wife was steadily poisoning him. More from intuition than any clear reasoning, he expected a crisis of distress either about 3 in the morning, during what the Navy emphatically called the graveyard watch, when so many people die, or else at dawn. He sat on, and although the ship was full of sound, the hissing rush of water along her side, the combined voices of all her rigging under a press of sail, the churn of the pumps, for with such a wind and such a sea she was hauling under the chains and making a fair amount of water, and from time to time the drumming of yet another squall, he was by now so accustomed to it that through the general roar he caught the strokes of the frigate's bell marking the watches through, and they often coincided with the minute, silvery chime of the watch in his pocket. He was accustomed to the room, too. At one time the frigate, as a regular man of war, had carried several midshipmen, master's mates, and others, and she needed 2 berths for them. Now, in her present ambiguous position of His Majesty's hired vessel Surprise, engaged in an unavowable intelligence mission, but going through the motions of being a privateer, by way of cover, she carried only 3, and a single berth, that on the starboard side, was enough. Earlier in the voyage from Sydney Cove, when the stowaway Clarissa was discovered and instantly married to the young gentleman who had concealed her, the couple had had this larboard berth to themselves, and he had often sat with her when the weather was foul and the deck impossible, though their frequent consultations had always taken place in his cabin, where the light was better. Dr. Maturin, as the frigate's surgeon, belonged officially to the gunroom mess. In fact, he nearly always lived in the great cabin with his particular friend Jack Aubrey, sleeping in one of the smaller cabins immediately forward of it. But he remained a member of the mess, and he was the only member of whom poor long-horned Oakes was not jealous. Yet he was the only member who was deeply attached to Clarissa as a person, rather than as a means to an end, and the only one who could have taken her affection away from Oakes, if it was affection that the young man valued. To be sure, Stephen was perfectly conscious of her desirability. He was an ordinary, sensual man in that respect, and although in his long period of opium-eating his ardour had so declined that continence was no virtue, it had since revived with more than common force. Yet in his view amorous conversation was significant only if the desire and the liking were shared, and early in their acquaintance it had become clear to him that physical love-making was meaningless to Clarissa, an act of not the slightest consequence. She took not the least pleasure in it, and although out of good nature or a wish to be liked she might gratify a lover, it might be said that she was chastely unchaste. At that time no moral question was involved. The experience of her childhood, loneliness in a remote country house, early abuse, and a profound ignorance of the ordinary world, accounted for her attitude of mind. There was no bodily imperfection. None of this was written on her forehead, however, nor was she apt to confide in anyone but her physician, and she was packed off with her husband in a prize bound for Batavia amid general disapprobation. They were to go home in an Indiaman, and there, perhaps, Mrs. Oakes would stay with Diana while her husband returned to the sea. He was passionately eager to succeed in the Navy. Stephen thought about her most affectionately. It was her courage that he most admired. She had had a very hard life in London and an appalling one in the convict settlement of New South Wales, but she had borne up admirably, retaining her own particular integrity, no self-pity, no complaint. And although he was aware that this courage might be accompanied by a certain ferocity, she had been transported for blowing a man's head off, he did not find it affected his esteem. As for her person, he liked that too. little evident immediate prettiness, but a slim, agreeable figure, and a very fine carriage. She was not as beautiful as Diana, with her black hair and blue eyes, but they both had the same straight back, the same thoroughbred grace of movement, and the same small head held high, though in Clarissa's case it was fair. Something of the same kind of courage, too. He hoped they would be friends. It was true that Diana's house contained Bridget, the daughter whom Stephen had not yet seen, and upon the whole Clarissa disliked children, yet Clarissa was a well-bred woman, affectionate in her own way, and unless the baby, or rather little girl by now, were quite exceptionally disagreeable, which he could not believe, she would probably make an exception. Bells, 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 and long, wandering thoughts between them. Martin quiescent. Eight bells, and the Starbolins, after a trying watch with frequent trimming of sail, taking reefs in and shaking them out, with much toil and anxiety over the rainwater, separating the foul from the clean, and with very frequent soakings, hurried below through the downpour to drip more or less dry in their hammocks. Jack remained on deck. The wind had slackened a little, and it was now coming in over the frigate's quarter. The sea was less lumpy. If this continued, and it was likely to do so, he could soon set to gallants. But neither the set of the sea nor the wind was his first concern at present. During the night they had lost the Franklin, and unless they could find her again, their sweep would be nothing like so efficient. Besides, with even the remote prospect of an action, his aim was always to bring a wholly decisive force into play. He was scarcely what would be called a timid man, but he far preferred a bloodless battle. Often and often he had risked his people and his ship, yet never when there was a real possibility of having such a weight of metal within range that no enemy in his right mind would resist. Colours struck, no bloodshed, no harm done, valuable powder returned to the magazine, and honour saved all round. He was, after all, a professional man of war, not a hero. This fellow, however, was said to be a pirate. Shelton had seen the black flag, and if he was a pirate, there was likely to be resistance or flight. Yet might it not have been that the Jolly Roger was hoisted for a cod, or as a way of disarming his legitimate privateer's prey by terror? Jack had known it done. True piracy was almost unheard of in these waters, whatever might be the case elsewhere. Though some privateers, far and far from land, might sometimes overstep the mark. And surely no downright pirate would have let a well-charged whaler go. The Surprise cared for neither flight nor fight, but still he did not want her scratched, nor any of her precious sailcloth and cordage hurt, and few sights would be more welcome than the Franklin. Her top lantern had vanished during the first three squalls of the night, reappearing in her due station on the starboard beam as each cleared, as much as it did clear in this thick weather. Yet after the long-lasting fourth it was no longer to be seen. At that time the wind was right aft, and this was the one point of sailing in which the Franklin, a remarkably well-built little craft, could draw away from the Surprise. Tom Pullings, the soul of rectitude, would never mean to do so, but with such a following sea the logline was a most fallible guide, and Jack therefore gazed steadily through the murk forward over the starboard bow. Even the murk was lessening too, and although the southeast was impenetrably black with the last squall racing from them, there were distinct rifts in the cloud astern, with stars showing clear. He had a momentary glimpse of Rigel Kent just above the crossjack yard, and with Rigel Kent at that height, dawn was no great way off. He also caught sight of Killick by the binnacle, holding an unnecessary napkin.
"Mr. Wilkins," he said to the officer of the watch, "I'm going below. I'm to be called if there is any change in the wind, or if any sail is sighted."
He ran down the companion ladder and into the welcome scent of coffee, the pot sitting there in gimbals under a lantern. He gathered his hair. Like most of the ship's company, he wore it long, but whereas the seaman's pigtails hung straight down behind, Jack's was clubbed, doubled back, and held with a bow. Yet all but the few close-cropped men had undone their plaits to let their salt-laden hair profit from the downpour, and very disagreeable they looked upon the whole, with long, dank strands plastered about their upper persons, bare in this warm rain. He gathered his hair, wrung it out, tied it loosely with a handkerchief, drank three cups of coffee with intense appreciation, ate an ancient biscuit and called for towels. Putting them under his wet head, he stretched out on the stern locker, asked for news of the doctor, heard Killick's, "Quiet as the grave, sir," nodded, and went straight to sleep in spite of the strong coffee and the even stronger thunder of the wave crests torn off by the wind and striking the deadlights that protected the flight of stern windows 6 inches from his left ear.
"Sir? Sir?"
called a voice in his right ear, a tremulous voice, the tall, shy, burly Norton sent to wake his commander.
"What is it, Mr. Norton?"
"Mr. Wilkins thinks he may hear gunfire, sir."
"Thank you. Tell him I shall be on deck directly."
Jack leapt up. He was draining the cold coffee pot when Norton put his head back through the door and said,
"Which he sent his compliments and duty to, sir."
By the time the surprise had pitched once with a slight corkscrew roll, Jack was at the head of the ladder in the dim half-light.
"Good morning, Mr. Wilkins," he said. "When away?"
"On a starboard bow, sir. It might be thunder, but I thought..."
It might well have been thunder, from the lightning-shot blackness over there.
"Masthead! Oh, masthead! What do you see?"
"Nothing, sir," called the lookout. "Black as hell down there."
Away to the larboard, the sun had risen 20 minutes ago. The scud overhead was grey, and through gaps in it, lighter clouds and even whitish sky could be seen. Ahead and on the starboard bow, all was black indeed. Astern, quite far astern, all was blacker still. The wind had hauled forward half a point, blowing with almost the same force. The sea was more regular by far, heavy still, but no cross-current. All those on deck were motionless, some with swabs poised, some with buckets and holy stones, unconscious of their immediate surroundings, every man's face turned earnestly, with the utmost concentration, to the blue-black east-south-east. A criss-cross of lightning down over there, then a low rumble accompanied by a sharp crack or two. Every man looked at his mate, as Wilkins looked at the captain.
"Perhaps," said Jack, "the arms chests into the half-deck at all events."
Minutes, indecisive minutes, passed. The cleaning of the deck resumed, a work of supererogation, if ever there was one. Wilkins sent two more hands to the wheel, for the squall astern was coming up fast in their wake.
"This may well be the last," said Jack,
seeing a patch of blue right overhead. He walked aft, leant over the heaving taffrail, and watched the squall approach, as dark as well could be, and lit from within by innumerable flashes, like all those that had passed over them that night. The blue was utterly banished, the day darkened.
"Come up the sheets," he called.
For the last quarter of a mile the squall was a distinct entity, sombre purple, sky tall, curving over at the top and with white water all along its foot, now covering half the horizon and sweeping along at an inconceivable speed for such a bulk. Then it was upon them. Blinding rain, shattered water driving so thick among the great heavy drops that one could hardly breathe, and the ship, as though given some frightful spur, leapt forward in the dark, confused turmoil of water. While the forefront of the squall enveloped them, and for quite long after its extreme violence had passed on ahead, time had little meaning. But as the enormous rain dwindled to little more than a shower, and the wind returned to its strong, steady southeast course, the men at the wheel eased their powerful grip, breathing freely and nodding to one another and the sodden quartermaster. The sheets were hauled aft. The ship, jetting rainwater from her scuppers, sailed on, accompanied for some time by low cloud that thinned and thinned, and then quite suddenly revealed high, blue, sunlit sky. A few minutes later the sun himself heaved out of the lead-coloured bank to larboard. This had indeed been the last of the series. The Surprise sailed on after it, directly in its track as it raced to the southeast, covering a vast breadth of sea with its darkness. On and on. And now, with the sun, they could clearly distinguish the squall's grim front from its grey, thinner tail, followed by a stretch of brilliant clarity, and at a given moment the foremast lookout's screaming hail,
"Sail ho! 2 sail of ships on the starboard bow! On deck there, 2 sail of ships on the starboard bow!"
brought no news, for they were already hull up as the darkness passed over and beyond them, suddenly present and clear to every man aboard. Jack was on his way to the foretop before the repetition. He levelled his glass for the first details, though the first glance had shown the essence of the matter. The nearer ship was the four-masted Alastor, wearing the black flag. She was grappled tight to the Franklin. They were fighting hand to hand on deck and between decks, and now, of course, there was no gunfire. Small arms, but no cannon.
"All hands, all hands!" he called. "T'gallants!"
He gauged their effect. Certainly she could bear them, and more. From the quarterdeck now he called for stunsails alow and aloft, and then for royals.
"Heave the log, Mr. Reed," he said.
He had brought the Alastor right ahead, broadside on, and in his glass he could see her trying to cast off, the Franklin resisting the attempt.
10 1/4, sir, if you please, said Reed at his side.
Jack nodded. The grappled ships were some 2 miles off. If nothing carried away, he should be alongside in 10 minutes, for the surprise would gather speed. Tom would hold on for 10 minutes if he had to do it with his teeth.
"Mr. Granger," he said, "beat to quarters."
It was the thunder of the drum, the piping and the cries down the hatchways, the deep growl and thump of guns being run out and the hurrying of feet that roused Martin.
"Is that you, Maturin?" he whispered, with a terrified sideways glance.
"It is," said Stephen, taking his wrist. "Good day to you now."
"Oh, thank God, thank God, thank God," said Martin, his voice broken with the horror of it. "I thought I was dead and in hell. This terrible room. Oh, this terrible, terrible room."
The pulse was now extremely agitated. The patient was growing more so.
"Maturin, my wits are astray. I am barely out of a night-long nightmare. Forgive me my trespasses to you."
"If you please, sir," said Reed, coming in. "The captain inquires for Mr. Martin and desires me to tell the doctor that we are bearing down on a heavy pirate engaged with a Franklin. There will be some broken omelettes presently."
"Thank you, Mr. Reed. Mr. Martin is far from well."
And calling after him,
"I shall repair to my station very soon."
"May I come?"
cried Martin.
"You may not," said Stephen. "You can barely stand, my poor colleague, sick as you are."
"Pray take me. I cannot bear to be left in this room. I hate and dread it. I could not bring myself to pass by its door even. This is where Mrs. Oakes. The wages of sin is death. I am rotting here in this life, while in the next, Christe eleison."
"Kyrie eleison," said Stephen. "But listen, Nathaniel, will you? You are not rotting, as the seamen put it, not at all. These are salt sores. They are no more, unless you have taken some improper physic. In this ship you could not have contracted any infection of that kind. There has been no source of infection, whether by kissing, toying, drinking in the same cup, or otherwise. None whatsoever. I state that as a physician."
The wind had hauled a little farther forward, and with her astonishing spread of drum-tight canvas, the Surprise was now running at such a pace that the following seas lapped idly alongside. From high aloft, Jack made out the confused situation with fair certainty. The ships were still grappled fast. The Alastors had boarded the Franklin's waist, but Tom had run up stout, close quarters, and some of his people were holding out behind them while others had invaded the Alastor's forecastle and were fighting the Frenchmen there. Some of the Alastors were still trying to cast off, and still the Franklins prevented them. Jack could see the bearded Sethians in the furious struggle that flung 3 Frenchmen bodily off the lashed bowsprits. Another group of pirates were turning one of the Franklin's forward carronades aft to blast a way through the close quarters, but the mob of their own men and deadly musket fire from their own forecastle hindered them, and the carronade ran wild on the rolling deck out of control. Jack called down,
"Chasers, crew away! Run them out!"
He landed on the deck with a thump, ran through the eager, attentive, well-armed groups to the bows, where his own brass Beelzebub was reaching far out of the port.
"For topsail," he said,
and they heaved the gun round. He and Bondon pointed it with grunts and half-words, the whole crew working as one man. Glaring along the sights, Jack pulled the lanyard, arched for the gun's recoil beneath him, and through the bellowing crash he roared,
"T'other!"
The smoke raced away before them, and barely was it clear before the other chaser fired. Both shots fulfilled their only function, piercing the foretopsail they were aimed at, dismaying the Alistairs, few ships could fire so clean, and encouraging the Franklins, whose cheer could now be heard, though faint and thin. But these two shots, reverberating through the ship's hollow belly, sent poor Martin's weakened mind clear off its precarious balance and into a delirium. His distress became very great, reaching the screaming pitch. Stephen quickly fastened him into his cot with two bandages and ran towards the sick berth. He met Padine on his way to tell him that quarters had been beaten.
"I know it," he replied. "Go straight along and sit with Mr. Martin. I shall come back."
He returned with the fittest of his patients, a recent hernia.
"See that all is well below, Padine," he said.
And when Padine had gone, he measured out a powerful dose from his secret store of laudanum, the tincture of opium to which he and Padine had once been so addicted.
"Now, John," he said to the seaman, "hold up his shoulders."
And in pause,
"Nathaniel? Nathaniel, my dear, here is your draught. Down it in one swallow, I beg."
The pause drew out.
"Lay him back. Lay him back gently," said Stephen. "He will be quiet now with the blessing. But you will sit with him, John, and soothe his mind if he wakes."
"Shipmates!" cried Jack from the break of the quarter-deck. "I'm going to lay alongside the foremaster as easy as can be. Some of our people are on her forecastle. Some of theirs are trying to work aft in the Franklin. So as soon as we are fast, come along with me and we will clear the foremaster's waist, then carry on to relieve Captain Pullings. But Mr. Granger's division will go straight along the Alistair's gun deck to stop them turning awkward with their cannon. None of you can go wrong if you knock an enemy on the head."
The seamen, a savage-looking crew with their long hair still wild about them, the seamen cheered, a strangely happy sound as the frigate glided in towards those embattled ships. Roaring shouts, the clash of bitter fighting clear and clearer over the narrowing sea. He stepped to the wheel, his heavy sword dangling from his wrist by a strap, and he took her shaving in, his heart beating high and his face gleaming, until her yards caught in the Alistair's shrouds and the ships ground together.
"Follow me! Follow me!"
he cried, leaping across, and on either side of him there were surprises, swarming over with cutlasses, pistols, boarding axes. Bondon was at his right hand, Awkward Davies on his left, already foaming at the mouth. The Alistairs came at them with furious spirit, and in the very first clash, halfway across the deck, one shot Jack's hat from his head, the bullet scoring his skull, and another, lunging with a long pike, brought him down.
"The captain's down!"
shrieked Davies. He cut the pikeman's legs from under him and Bondon split his head. Davies went on hacking the body as the Franklins came howling down and took the Alistairs in the flank. There was an extremely dense and savage melee, with barely room to strike, cruel blows for all that and pistols touching the enemy's face. The battle surged forward and back. More joined in, forward and back, turning, trampling on bodies, dead and living, all sense of direction lost, a slaughter momentarily interrupted by the crash of the Franklin's carronade, turned and fired at last, but misfired, misaimed, so that it killed many of those it was meant to help. The remaining Alistairs came flooding back into their own ship, instantly pursued by Pulling's men, who cut them down from behind while the surprises shattered them from in front and either side, for they had all heard the cry,
"The captain's down! They've got the captain!"
And the fighting reached an extraordinary degree of ferocity. Presently it was no more than broken men escaping below, screaming as they were hunted down and killed, and an awful silence fell. Only the ships creaking together on the dying sea and the flapping of empty sails. A dozen black slaves were found shut in the Alistair's orlop, as well as a few wretched little rouged and scented boys, and they were put to throwing the dead over the side. Long before they reached his part of the deck, Jack Aubrey heaved himself from beneath three bodies and one desperately wounded man.
"It was as bloody a little set to as ever I've seen," he said to Pullings, sitting by him on the combing, trying to staunch the flow from his wound and dabbing at his bloody eye. "How are you, Tom?" he asked again.
"And how is the ship?"